the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, and the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. For more information on that conference, visit www.israellobbycon.org. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 37th annual Sing Time Weekend Retreat of Portland Folk Music Society. From 6 p.m. March 25th until noon on March 27th, at the Minucha Conference Center in Corbett. Sing Time features workshops, song circles, concerts, and lots of singing and jamming in a residential setting. A scholarship fund is available, and vaccinations and masks are required. Again, that's Portland Folk Music Society's Sing Time Weekend Retreat, starting at 6 p.m. on Friday, March 25th, at the Minucha Conference Center, 38711 E Historic Columbia River Highway in Corbett. More information can be found at portlandfolkmusic.org/singtime.
Hi there, this is Juan Carlos Ordóñez, host of Policy for the People. And before we get to today's show, I want to remind you that this is a great time to become a member of KBOO. Help us meet our $15,000 All Thrills, No Frills campaign goal. We're community funded, so we need your support to get there. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Welcome to Policy for the People, a show that explores the public policies that can lift up all Oregonians. This show is a collaboration between KMUZ Radio and the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I am your host, Juan Carlos Ordóñez. Jackson and Jill, the first television sitcom, aired in 1949. It featured a family structure rehashed in many TV shows to follow. A working husband and a stay-at-home wife.
Just think, in 5 little old hours, we'll be on our way. 2 weeks of happy, gay, carefree, lighthearted fun at Mountain Springs Inn.
2 weeks of no dishes to wash.
2 weeks of not having to get up at 6:45.
2 weeks of no washing, scrubbing, or cleaning the apartment.
2 weeks of freedom from that desk down at the office.
Oh, vacations—they're
wonderful.
That family structure, largely fictional even back then, wasn't just fodder for early TV comedy. It was also the premise of a monumental change to the federal tax code, unveiled a year earlier. In 1948, Congress established the system of joint filing for married couples, a structure that rewards families with a sole breadwinner. With March being Women's History Month, it's a great moment to reflect on how the tax code impacts gender justice. And to discuss that topic, I'm pleased to welcome Amy Matsui, Director of Income Security and Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. The center works to advance gender justice. Among other things, Amy and her colleagues have done a lot of research on how the tax code impacts women, people of color, and low-income families. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start by talking about one of the foundational biases in the U.S. tax system, and that is the joint filing tax system. Can you explain to the listeners what the joint tax filing system is, and which family structures does it favor, and which does it disadvantage?
So joint filing means that a married couple combines their income and files their taxes as a unit. The tax rate that they get is based on the combined level of income. So think about a couple of different family structures. When the tax code was written in the early 20th century, it was primarily written by white wealthy men. And their frame of reference from what a marriage looked like was a male breadwinner and their wife was a stay-at-home spouse who took care of the children. But think about a different family structure where, for example, the wife earns some income, but given all of the inequities in the workforce, family expectations, caregiving, say that she earns less than her male spouse does. In that case, if she's thinking about going into the workforce, something that the couple may take into consideration is the fact that her income will be taxed at a much higher rate because it's combined with her spouse's than if she were working and supporting herself. On the one hand, it recognizes that there is kind of an economic unit here. On the other, people sometimes think about this as a barrier. Is it worth it for the female spouse to go back to work if she's going to earn less, get taxed more, and all of these things? Another family structure to think about is if there are two earners. This is much more likely to be the case for Black and Brown couples, especially because Black and Brown women have always been in the workforce, have always been earning. So for them, they're in kind of the same situation where both of them are going to be taxed at a higher rate than if they were filing taxes on their own. They're not going to get the same preferential rates if they file as married separately, and they may in fact lose out on some benefits like the earned income tax credit if their combined income is too high. So these are both situations where we're going to confront kind of what's commonly called a marriage penalty because of different family structures than kind of what the drafters of the modern tax code had in mind based on their own experience.
Just to make a point clear is that it doesn't have to be that way. There could be a different system, a different assumption that people just file taxes as individuals rather than as couples. Is that right?
That's 100% right. There are a number of countries across the world where even married couples file their taxes separately and their tax liabilities are determined separately.
So the joint tax filing system illustrates a key thing to understand about the tax system, and that is that it's a political and social document. Can you talk about how the tax system's treatment of women has evolved over our country's history?
Absolutely. I mean, I think another example of kind of the racial and gender biases which are embedded in the tax system is how the tax code treats childcare expenses for adults in a family to work or look for work. So right now, as you may know, there is a tax credit for child and dependent care expenses. When this credit was initially being discussed in the Congress, at that point in the 1950s, it was originally a deduction. Something that policymakers were extremely worried about is whether this would push more women into the workforce and cause them to actually neglect their primary role as a caregiver. Their children would be running wild in the streets. And they also were worried about why women wanted to go back to work. Was it because they wanted to earn spending money for themselves? So I think that the way that the tax code and the debates around different tax benefits for childcare expenses really does show some of the biases of tax writers. It was definitely a concern about basically middle-class white women going into the paid workforce, neglecting their duties at home, and really ignored the experience of women of color, mothers who were raising children on their own, who didn't really have a choice about going back to work.
Any other examples of the ways in which gender biases are woven into the tax code that you want to highlight?
There's one other that I'd love to spend a little time on, and that is the taxation of kind of litigation damages. If someone has worker compensation damages that are awarded for a physical injury or other kind of lawsuit-related settlements for physical injury, those settlements are not taxed. In contrast, if there is a race or sex or disability discrimination claim that doesn't involve a physical injury, those settlements or damages are actually taxed. And I just think that's a really striking example because, you know, race, gender, disability discrimination claims are going to be more likely to be claimed by women, by people of color, whereas we do have some evidence that, for example, workman's compensation claims, and you can hear the word man in the original term workers' compensation, do tend to be claimed more by men. So that is another kind of difference which is baked into the tax code.
One of the big inequities in both the U.S. tax system and Oregon's tax system is the mortgage interest deduction, which is, in Oregon's case, the biggest housing subsidy that we have in our state. Nationally, it is also a massive housing subsidy that basically you have to be a homeowner to even potentially get the benefit of the mortgage interest deduction. We've written a lot about how it is mainly a subsidy for well-off homeowners. It completely leaves out renters. It disadvantages low-income, even low-income homeowners, rural Oregonians, people of color. Your analysis also shows that the mortgage interest deduction has a gender bias. Can you explain why that is and the impact of that bias?
I do think that the way that the mortgage interest deduction is structured is more of a reward for people who can afford to purchase a home rather than something that actually helps them accomplish it. So because, you know, there's a huge wealth differential between women, especially women of color who are supporting families on their own, and other, you know, men, and even compared to white women, certainly. So that means they're going to be less likely to have a home and be able to qualify from this deduction. One of the other things I think that factors into the impact of the tax code is understanding that lower tax brackets, lower income brackets, there's going to be an overrepresentation of women supporting households on their own and households of color, whereas for the higher income levels, you're going to have an underrepresentation. Higher income brackets are more likely to be able to receive the mortgage interest deduction and get more benefit from it. In part, that's because to even get the mortgage interest deduction, as I mentioned, you have to have the wherewithal to get a house. But in addition, to claim the mortgage interest deduction, you have to itemize your deduction. And that means you have to have more things like, you know, charitable deductions or other deductions that total more than the standard deduction. Most families that are, or households that claim itemized deductions, are going to be earning upwards of, you know, $150,000, $200,000. Otherwise, it's just math that doesn't make sense. And then the final thing I'll note is that the mortgage interest deduction is going to be larger for more expensive mortgages, which you get generally on larger homes. And again, those are households among whom women supporting families on their own and households of color are going to be underrepresented.
The mortgage interest deduction is one way that the tax code worsens wealth inequality, but it's hardly the only one. Can you talk about other parts of the tax code that worsen wealth inequality by gender?
One other kind of area to think about how the tax code deals with wealth is around savings, and specifically retirement savings. So again, this harkens back a little bit to the drafters of the modern tax code who had in mind, you know, a worker who goes through life, they start at a lower salary, they are going to earn more over the course of their career, and that makes it possible for that person, theoretically, to save. So the idea is, you know, you can save more and more over retirement when you're, you know, in your mid-50s earning the kind of the peak of your earnings, you have an opportunity to put even more money away. And under kind of the retirement savings plans that are offered by employers, there is a tax preference there. So that for a 401k, people can take money out of their paychecks before they pay income taxes and put those aside for retirement savings. So there are a whole bunch of assumptions baked into that policy, which don't really fit the lives of women, and especially not of women of color. First of all, you have to work in a job where your employer offers a retirement savings plan. For a lot of low-paid professions, think about restaurant work, retail, home care, childcare, that's not a benefit that's available. So those workers who are predominantly women and over-concentrated women of color don't even have the opportunity to save. The second thing is that even if you have that plan, you have to be able to take money out of your paycheck to save. And again, for women who are kind of in these low wage jobs that don't have an upward trajectory, if there's any kind of increase in pay over time, it's a miracle. That savings is just not practical. People need those every dime out of their paycheck to make ends meet and support their families. For people who aren't able to accumulate those savings, that's a missed opportunity to accumulate wealth. When you contrast that with the ways that the tax code really privileges certain kinds of income from wealth or doesn't tax some kinds of wealth at all, that really is something that leads to a widening and really stark racial and gender wealth gap.
Can you give us a couple examples of what you just mentioned in terms of the kinds of wealth that are lightly taxed or sort of privileged when in the tax code?
One example of this is, you know, if you have stock and there are profits from your stock and it's paid back as a dividend, that dividend is considered income. But the dividend is taxed at a lower rate than regular income. It's taxed at about 20%, whereas the highest level of taxation is about 37%. When you think about the fact that most people who own stock are in higher income tax brackets, that means that this income from wealth is going to be taxed lower than the income from work or labor. One other example is that, you know, if someone holds an asset, and let's say, for example, it's a piece of land. If the piece of land increases in value between the time that you buy it over time, that increase in value only is taxed if you sell the property. And those are called your capital gains. It's the gain in value of your capital asset. The reason that this is kind of problematic is that people can get economic benefit from that increase in value even if they don't sell it. They can borrow against the land. They can, transfer it over to their heirs, and the value transfers over and no one ever pays tax on the increase in value. Those are just a couple of different ways that wealth and income from wealth is treated differently from income from work, and really leads to kind of this growing wealth gap.
We're taking this short break to remind you that this is KBOO's All Thrill, No Frills special winter drive programming. Help us reach our goal of $15,000 before March 19th. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. And now, back to the show. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Amy Matsui, Director of Income Security and Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. And we're discussing how the tax code impacts gender justice. So we've been discussing some of the very negative aspects of the tax code when it comes to disadvantaging women and people of color, but it's also important to recognize that there are some good aspects to the tax code, provisions that help advance equity, including gender equity. Can you give us some examples of that?
Absolutely. So just to kind of take a step back, our tax system is actually progressive on the income tax side. And what that means is that there are higher income tax rates as income goes up. So the last dollars of income for the highest income folks are going to be taxed at a higher rate than lower earners. And that's to recognize that people at the higher end of the income scale have more of an ability to pay. In addition, there are a number of provisions that really do go far in advancing racial and gender justice. And I'm going to focus on refundable tax credits as one particular mechanism in the tax code that does promote equity. So because women, especially women of color, are overrepresented in lower wage brackets, in low wage work, they're going to be even more benefited by refundable tax credits. And a refundable tax credit just means that if someone has $50 of tax liability by the time they go through their whole tax return, and they have a tax credit that is $100 and it's refundable, they'll get their $50 of tax liability wiped away, but then they can get the $50 back as a refund. And that refund, you know, will help them. People use tax refunds to make big purchases, to pay off debt, to reduce their credit cards. It's something that really does improve people's standard of living, and income boosts from refundable tax credits have been shown consistently over time to improve child and family well-being, health, educational outcomes, eventual employment. So they really are something that has improved the well-being of women, children, and families. Refundable tax credits like the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is designed as kind of a permanent boost for low-wage workers, the Child Tax Credit, which is supposed to help offset some of the costs of raising children. These are refundable tax credits that especially benefit families of color, children of color, women of color, and therefore they do increase equity in the tax code.
So the child tax credit that you mentioned has been in the news quite a bit over the past year. A year ago, Congress passed the American Rescue Plan, which was the last big pandemic relief package. And it included a very significant expansion of the child tax credit. And unfortunately, that expansion was only temporary. It expired this past January. There's been a certain amount of data that has rolled in studying the impact of this expansion. Can you share with us what we know was accomplished by that expansion of the child tax credit, what we've learned about its effectiveness as a tax policy?
We really have seen the incredible impact that the expanded child tax credit has had on families in real time. Under the American Rescue Plan Act, the amount of the child tax credit was expanded so that it is worth $3,600 for children per child for children under age six, and $3,000 for children ages 6 through 17. Ordinarily, the child tax credit was worth $2,000. And in addition, the American Rescue Plan Act made the credit refundable for families, even those who don't have any earned income. Under prior law, oddly enough, if you didn't earn $2,500 in earned income, you couldn't get a refund from the child tax credit. And this especially harmed, you know, Black and Brown children, Black and Latinx families in particular were left out when the credit was not fully refundable. Last but not least, the American Rescue Plan Act allowed families to receive up to half of their child tax credit amount as monthly payments between July and December. So every month, families were receiving, on the 15th, were receiving a child tax credit advance. What we saw was that families were using these advanced child tax credit payments to pay for necessities, to catch up on bills. There was a lot of child tax credit payments that were used for food, to catch up on rent, school supplies when it hit in the summer. The other thing that we saw is that from month to month, children were boosted out of poverty, and the child tax credit payments between December and January alone reduced child poverty by nearly 40%. That is an amazing kind of real-time result to have seen. I'll note that there was survey evidence that showed that parents said that it was easier for them to work because of the child tax credit payments. And this really counters a lot of concern that was expressed that if parents were getting extra money, it would discourage them from going to work. And the last thing that I'll note is that the monthly payments reduced families' financial stress. It gave them a little bit of a cushion, especially during this especially dire and volatile economic time, just to kind of meet their bills and know that they could get the necessities and put food on the table from month to month. It really did give families peace of mind. So this is really a resounding policy success.
The one unfortunate thing was that that expansion was temporary, so it has expired now. And President Biden's proposed Build Back Better legislation would have extended the improvements to the child tax credit. That legislation has stalled. It seems like there's pretty clear reasons why we would want to make improvements to the child tax credit permanent, right?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, so many families, even before the pandemic, were trying to make it from paycheck to paycheck. You definitely have seen consistently over time, very few families are able to meet even, you know, a $400 emergency expense. Surveys done by the Fed show that, you know, 40% of families can't meet that kind of expense with cash on hand. So a policy like the child tax credit, if it, you know, can help make those paycheck to paycheck transitions a little bit easier, provide a cushion against financial shocks, but also if we're able to make this credit fully available and fully refundable for families, especially the lowest income families, one other change I think that would be really significant is to make sure that children who are claimed for the credit who don't have Social Security numbers but instead have individual tax identification numbers can be claimed. This would help mixed status immigrant families in particular. So these are all aspects of the child tax credit which would make it easier for a huge swath of families and have the continued benefits that we noticed over this past year: decreased material hardship, increased well-being, and drops in poverty.
Besides strengthening the child tax credit and other improvements that you talked about, what other policy changes would be most impactful in terms of having a tax system that advances gender justice?
So one thing that would definitely increase gender and racial justice in the tax code is to increase the revenues that are collected by the tax system in a more fair and equitable and progressive way. So for example, the 2017 Trump tax cuts lowered the corporate income tax, the corporate tax rate. They lowered the tax rate for top earners. And, you know, as we've seen during the pandemic, there was suffering and material hardship and economic stress that people at the lower end of the income scale experienced, while the same was not true for higher income folks. It's definitely way past time to make sure that the very wealthy large corporations are paying their fair share, and the revenues that would be raised by those more progressive and fair taxes could be invested in the kinds of things that really do help build economic security, financial security, and community stability in healthcare, childcare, paid family and medical leave, education. Those are all things that kind of help build an economy that works for all of us. A couple of other policy changes that would increase racial and gender equity include giving the IRS more resources to enforce the tax laws that are on the books. There right now is a really significant gap between the taxes that are owed under current law and the taxes that are collected, in part because, you know, higher income folks may be able to hire a phalanx of lawyers to work around and reduce their tax liability, or just stall knowing that the IRS has fewer resources to go after really complex tax bills. And then the very last thing that I'll mention is having more information about who benefits from tax expenditures, who benefits from different provisions of the tax code, by breaking out more data on, you know, race, gender, as well as income. This would give us a better view to know what tax policies are increasing race and gender equity and which are falling short of the mark.
Before we end, is there any other point that you'd like to bring up that we haven't covered thus far?
So I think there has been a lot of attention and thought in the past couple of years about better ways to tax wealth. You know, we do have some forthcoming work around that. So please, we hope that you'll follow the National Women's Law Center's tax and gender equity work and engage with us around that. But it's a really exciting area of work that really would increase, you know, the progressivity and equity of the tax code and kind of help to lower the wealth gap on the top end to help reduce the wealth gap overall.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for coming on Policy for the People, and we really appreciate your insights.
So happy to join you, excited to talk about taxes and racial and gender justice any day of the week.
Thank you for listening to Policy for the People. Please show your support for this and all of KABU's great programming by supporting the All Thrills, No Frills campaign. Help us reach our goal of $15,000 before March 19th. Go to kboo.fm/give. Or text KBOO to 44321. Thank you and see you next time.
Welcome to another episode of Film at 11 here on Community Radio KBOO Portland. Batting first, Jeff Godsell revisits The Day the Earth Stood Still, directed by Robert Wise and released in 1953.
Wikipedia describes the golden age of science fiction as having different eras. First, the pulp era of the 20s and 30s with